The first argued case this morning is number 21-1537, Zollstop Holding, LLC, against Vidal. Mr. Newton.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jared Newton for the appellant, Zollstop Holding, LLC. Before I get started, I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal time. This case involves two consolidated appeals, both of which relate to patent term adjustment determinations by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office under 35 U.S.C. 154. I'll start with the 796 patent, which is the first one addressed in the blue brief. The 796 patent presents a straightforward application of the statutory text. The subsection that's at issue here, subsection C3, provides for a patent term adjustment if a patent issues under an appellate decision reversing an adverse determination of patentability. Here, the 796 patent, the underlying application, was subject to an adverse determination of patentability in the form of an anticipation rejection that the examiner issued, and the PTAB then upheld on appeal within the Patent Office. And so Zollstop filed a Section 145 appeal to the District Court for the District of Columbia. That appeal lasted 7 years, at the conclusion of which the District Court held that the anticipation rejection was reversed, thus triggering the plain text of the statute, reversing an adverse determination of patentability.
We're talking about Claim 1, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Claim 1 issue in that patent?
Claim 1 was later amended to incorporate...
It was canceled, right?
It was canceled and incorporated into the limitations of Claim 2. And this goes to a point that the Patent Office raised, which is they focus very specifically on the claim that was subject to appeal. But the statute doesn't talk about the claim. The statute talks about the patent that issues under the appellate decision. And so Congress, when it was drafting the statute, didn't say, in order to get a patent term adjustment under subsection C, you have to maintain that same claim that was subject to appeal.
So I understand the reason why we're here on appeal with regard to the 796 patent, and that your opening left out was the fact that not only was there an anticipation rejection on the claim one of the 796, but there was also a provisional ODP rejection. And so when it came back from the district court in the 145, there was still the lingering provisional ODP rejection, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So therefore, this case in part comes down to what does the statute mean when it talks about an adverse determination of patentability, and did the district court in fact reverse an adverse determination of patentability if the claim on the way back still had to contend with this provisional obviousness type double patenting rejection? I mean, that claim one could not issue after the district court opinion came back, right?
That's correct. The claim as it came out remained subject to this provisional non-statutory double patenting rejection that the applicant did have to account for, which led to the cancellation of claim one and the incorporation.
Is there a reason why you didn't challenge the double patenting rejection at the district court level?
The case was filed challenging the PTAB's decision overall.
Right, and the PTAB decision affirmed the anticipation rejection and the double patenting rejection, as I understand it.
That is correct.
Okay, and then you appealed that through a 145 civil action, which you're entitled to.
That's correct.
But for whatever reason, you only challenged the anticipation rejection, and you did not challenge the double patenting rejection. Is that right?
That is correct.
So yeah. I'm just trying to understand, why would you do that?
Well, partly because of the procedural posture of the appeal. The appeal from the Patent Office went to the District Court for the District of Columbia, and then it was stayed pending resolution of a related appeal that Zollstop had undertaken that was dealing with the same issue, whether this Freeman prior art reference was enabled for the limitation that was at issue. So the appeal that actually occurred with respect to the 796 patent was put on hold for 7 years while this other appeal played out. And then when the other appeal finished, which culminated in the detailed opinion saying Freeman is not enabled, there was a one-paragraph order in this appeal where the court said, we're reversing the anticipation rejection, remanding to the PTAB.
Mr. Newton, let me give a little hypothetical. Let's suppose there's an application with two independent claims, Claim 1 and Claim 2. Claim 1 is rejected, goes up on appeal. The appeal takes 7 years. The appellant prevails, and then it goes back, and the appellant, for whatever reason, just cancels claim one. So the only claim left is claim two, which was allowed in the first place. Is that issuing patent entitled to a patent term adjustment?
Under the text of the statute, it is, because the statute, again, focuses on the patent that issued as a result of the appeal or following the appeal decision.
It talks about the patent that issued as a result of the reversal of a determination of patentability. There was no determination of patentability with respect to claim two.
Well, I think that goes a little bit too far into reading into the statute this requirement that the patent issues as a result. That phrase does not appear in the statute.
It says issues under the appellate. So what is your understanding of issued under?
Under is a temporal limitation.
It's not beneath, right?
Well, below, I think, is fair. Below or beneath. But it's the purpose of the statute.
But that's not the meaning of under in Section 154, right? It doesn't mean below or beneath.
If you read it in the context of the statute, I believe that absolutely is the meaning. And that is the only way to give effect to the purpose of the statute.
Well, there's an alternative meaning. Under also commonly is the same thing as pursuant to or as a result of.
Well, we don't think that makes sense, because if you read it as a result of or pursuant to, both of which were discussed during the legislative history and not included into the statute. They adopted this broader term under. But if you impose this result requirement in the statute, then you have to decide if an appellate decision is actually making a patentability determination. And the PTAB on appeal, the district court for District of Columbia, doesn't make those patentability determinations. It looks at the record below, like an appeals court, and says, was it right or was it wrong? And the statute says if the appeals court or the PTAB says it was wrong, there's an adverse determination of patentability and that's wrong, the applicant should get compensated for that. And Judge Lynn, turning back to your hypothetical, there's a practical idea here too, which is if you take this case, 7 years on appeal, there's a lot that can change. We pointed out in our briefing, SolStop filed an ITC action. They had a number of IPRs filed against their related patents. During that long period of time, a lot can happen that will cause the patentee to want to make certain changes, whether they want to cancel claims or draft new claims to focus on a new aspect of the technology. They want to amend the claims to account for prior art that came to light in a parallel proceeding. The statute permits them to do that. And conversely, the statute shouldn't be restrictive and say, patentee, SolStop, you need to choose. Either you can continue prosecution after the appeal, or you get a patent term adjustment. The statute's not drafted to force that choice.
Here's the problem I'm having, is that you make some very interesting and not unreasonable arguments about when there should be a patent term adjustment and what circumstances might warrant a patent term adjustment. And all of these are reasonable considerations, but Congress passed a statute which is fairly specific. And that's what we have to live with. And it seems to me that what you're trying to do is to read out of this statute an entire phrase, the phrase in which the patent was issued under a decision in review, so that the statute simply reads, if the issuance is delayed due to appellate review in a case reversing an adverse determination of patentability, that's enough. But that's not what the statute says.
It says issued under, but
under a decision in the review, reversing an adverse determination of patentability. In my hypothetical, claim two was allowed in the first instance, that it was not. That patent was not issued under a decision in review reversing an adverse determination of patentability, because claim two was allowed even before the appeal.
Let me make two responses. First, the concept of issued under, if you take a narrower interpretation of it where you have to say the patent actually issues as a result of the appeal decision, well, then there's ambiguity in the statute of what does that mean? What does an appeal decision have to do to effectively issue the patent as a result of that decision. And then the second point, your hypothetical, is, which I understand it, and I still think the statute applies to it, but this situation is narrower than your hypothetical. In this situation, what we had was only one anticipation rejection, and we pointed to some of the case law, like the Donaldson case, that says an anticipation rejection is a patentability determination. That was the only adverse determination of patentability. In the words of Donaldson, the words of the Aristocrat case.
There's the double patenting rejection at the same time. There were two different grounds for rejecting claim one. One was the anticipation rejection. The other one was the double patenting rejection. And after the district court action, there was still the double patenting rejection. So therefore, the claims continued to remain unpatentable after the issuance of the district court opinion in the 145 action.
Well, I disagree that they were unpatentable as a result of the double patenting rejection because it was provisional. But even if you put that point aside, the provisional
point
aside...
The patent could not issue with a provisional double patenting rejection pending. Do we agree on that?
I agree on that, yeah. The applicant had to take, you know, steps, either amend the claims or file a terminal disclaimer.
Right, but so when we in that sense, the status of the claim post-145 action was unpatentable. The claim was still unpatentable.
I disagree because I think that a provisional double patenting rejection doesn't have the force or effect of an actual rejection. And it's also not a statutory condition for patentability. The only statutory condition that was on appeal was the anticipation rejection, which was indisputably reversed.
Double patenting rejections don't count?
They don't count as a statutory condition for patentability. That's the Aristocrat decision, which says 101, 102, 103... those are the statutory conditions for patentability. Donaldson, too, makes the same point. And there are other requirements, in the words of the Aristocrat decision, non-statutory double patenting, provisional double patenting might be one of those, but it's not a statutory ground for patentability.
But it doesn't say statutory ground for patentability. It says adverse determination of patentability.
Right, and determination
so
of patentability.
So double patenting rejection, an adverse determination of patentability?
I don't believe it is, no. If you look at the Donaldson case, which is an en banc case, the entire court is identifying patentability determinations as anticipation.
In Ray Donaldson, obviously, I think we would both agree, doesn't get into the statutory question or the question of how to understand what is a determination of patentability versus not a determination of patentability. It just happened to talk about different determinations of patentability in a more casual sense.
Well, I think it supports the idea that when we're talking about patentability determinations, those are the requirements that we are talking about, not other requirements. And when you read that in connection with the Aristocrat case, you have other requirements for a valid patent.
So getting back to the meaning of under, where you say it means below, what would the statute mean if we replaced under with below in a case in which the patent was issued below a decision in the review reversing an adverse determination of patentability? I mean, replacing under with below doesn't make sense to me.
I respectfully disagree. It fulfills the purpose of the statute.
What does it mean to be issued below a decision in the review?
It means that during the course of prosecution, the patent application was subject to an appeal that the applicant had to undertake.
By a decision below, it's issued below a decision under your reading of the statute.
Right, which means the issuance occurred after an appeal, which happened sometime during the course of prosecution. And again, that's the way to give purpose to the statute. If I have to undertake an appeal to overcome a bad rejection, regardless of where that occurs along the timeline of prosecution, my patent term is still impacted by that. And that's why the statute was drafted to compensate the applicant regardless of where along the line the appeal occurs. That's why it's in terms of the patent, not a particular claim that has to be subject to the appeal. And it doesn't say the particular claim has to actually come out of the appeal. Briefly, I've got 1 minute before my rebuttal time. I just want to touch on the 476 patent. There are overlapping issues because it's the same statutory provision. But the adverse determination of patentability was an obviousness rejection that the examiner made. And Solstop had to, again, undertake an appeal to actually get that obviousness rejection removed, that bar to patentability, and to allow prosecution to continue. So it's the same idea that they had no choice but to undertake that appeal to keep prosecution going, and yes, they continued prosecution after the appeal because the PTAB had entered a new ground of rejection, but that shouldn't take away.
So the claim that was on appeal was still subject to rejection after the appeal as it was before the appeal, correct?
Well, not the same rejection. It was
different rejection, it was a but different still rejection. Subject to rejection.
Before and after, yes, the claim was rejected.
So it was the subject of an adverse patentability determination both before and after.
Yes, but different patentability determinations. And when you look at the statute, it says an adverse determination of patentability, which Solstop overcame. And with that, I'll yield to my colleague. Unless there's
Thank
any
you.
Other questions.
I will save your rebuttal time. Mr. Chan.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Hung Chan, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney here today representing the defendant appellee, Ms. Catherine Vidal, or the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. When a rejected claim is appealed to the Patent Trial and Appeal Board or to a federal district court, common sense dictates that a successful appeal is one where the claim emerges patentable. And that is the lens with which to view this case about whether the 476 patent and the 796 patent are entitled to a patent term adjustment, or PTA, under 35 U.S.C. section 154B1C3, which I will refer to as the C delay provision for today. Neither of these patents is entitled to C delay because no appellate body reversed an adverse determination of patentability, and the patents didn't issue under any such reversal. With respect to Claim 11 of the underlying application for the 476 patent, as Judge Lynn alluded to, the examiner had determined that the claim was unpatentable as obvious. That rejection, or that ground of unpatentability, was appealed to the board. And although the board did change the underlying rationale for why the particular references rendered that claim unpatentable, it nevertheless affirmed the obviousness rejection.
Well, let's be precise, because the PTAB didn't just come up with a new rationale. They basically concluded that the rejection under appeal could not be sustained, but they issued a new ground of rejection. It was the same. It was still a 103 obviousness rejection, but it was a new ground of rejection, such that when it went back, the applicant had the right to respond and continue prosecution. So I just want to be clear on that. But my question to you is, let's suppose that in this case the PTAB had reversed the rejection, and then it went back and the examiner decided to apply the new 103 rejection, the same one that the PTAB did. Under those circumstances, and ultimately the applicant prevails and convinces the examiner that that rejection should be withdrawn, is the applicant entitled to a patent term adjustment under those circumstances?
Your Honor, if I understand your hypothetical correctly, I think it falls within the last sentence of 37 CFR 1.702E, in which it lays out some circumstances in which an applicant would be entitled to a C delay, and I think in your hypothetical, that applicant would be. To be clear, as I understand it, the appealed claim would ultimately have the patentability ruling reversed, such that at that time, when it comes back down, when it's remanded to the examiner, it's actually assuming all the conditions of allowability, other conditions of allowability are satisfied. If it's allowed to be allowed at that point, then yes, that whatever patent ultimately issues from that claim would be entitled to C delay.
But why should it make a difference as to whether this sort of second go-around for the 103 rejection, the alternative ground of rejection or new ground of rejection, what difference does it make or should it make for patent term adjustment, whether that's done by the PTAB or by the examiner?
Your Honor, it's the difference is because it adheres to the words of the statute. The words of the statute.
In both cases, there's a delay, and in both cases, the ground of patentability, the patentability determination that was initially subject to appeal was reversed.
Your Honor, that is a policy choice that Congress has made, and these decisions and the conduct of the PTO is strictly being adhered, is just adhering to the plain words of the statute. And so what Congress wants in order for there to be C delay is that there is a patent that was issued under a decision in the review reversing an adverse determination of patentability.
So you're reading the statute sort of literally and narrowly as you believe Congress intended.
Your Honor, I'm certainly reading it literally. I'm not sure if narrowly is the right way to think about it. I think I'm reading it with just the right amount of width and, you know, length. So,
well, let's talk about that policy choice. Here we have a situation where the patent has not been granted, hasn't been issued. Therefore, the patentee has none of the benefits of having a patent, and yet time is running, measured from the filing date. The legislative policy was that the patentee would not be prejudiced in that case, and yet the office, you're telling us that the policy is that the time runs even though the patentee doesn't have the patent because prosecution one way or another is continuing, either with other claims or for any other reason. And you are telling us that that is the legislative intent?
Yes, Your Honor. The PTA bill, I believe that was
passed. How can it be the legislative intent when the entire purpose of enacting the adjustment was to remedy exactly what you're telling us is happening?
Your Honor, the legislative intent in the committee reports that were cited in the brief show that Congress intended to compensate inventors and applicants for certain types of delay. And so they've been clearly promulgated in, you know, three separate provisions, A, B, and C delay. And with respect to this, Your Honor's question seems to suggest that because maybe the PTO was at fault here, that the applicant should be entitled to some form of delay. And my response to that sort of inquiry would be that is a policy decision that Congress has made. Again, certain types of delay are entitled to compensation. And I would just also point out in the court's past precedent, not necessarily on C delay, but with respect to A delay, that was cited in the brief, the Pfizer case and the Idorinesia case, it was arguable that the PTO was at fault there because they issued incorrect notices of restriction, and yet this court also held under the relevant PTA provision that the applicant was not entitled to any sort of delay that may have been at the fault of the PTO. Your Honor, getting back to the reversal, the requirement of a reversal of an adverse determination of patentability, with respect to the second application at issue, the 527, or the underlying application of the 796 patent, again, that the examiner have found that the claim, the relevant claim, was unpatentable as anticipated, as well as subject to a ODP rejection. Ultimately, when the claim was appealed to the district court, the anticipation rejection was reversed, but nevertheless, there was still an ODP rejection remaining, rendering the claim unpatentable. And so therefore, SawStop then went and actually canceled the claim. So that claim that was even at issue before the D.C. District Court was never in the ultimate patent that issued. And so for those reasons, neither Claim 11 of the 829 application or Claim 1 of the 527 application were issued under a reversal of an adverse determination of patentability.
What, Mr. Chan, what do you think issued under a decision in the review means? Do you think that means that a claim that was actually before the board or the district court in this action, in this case, where there was a reversal of any and all rejections against that claim actually ends up appearing in the final patent as is? Is that how we should think of under a decision?
Like, yes, Your Honor.
Because of that decision, that claim that had been previously determined to be unpatentable became patentable and therefore issued in the patent.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would point to the word before was issued under in the statute. So the relevant phrase would be patent that was issued under a decision in the review reversing an adverse determination of patentability. So that patent has that ultimately issues has to be somehow tied or traceable to a reversal of an adverse determination of patentability. So
I asked this question because there was something in one of the regulations that looked kind of confusing in 1.702E, I think.
Yes.
And there was a statement in that regulation that seemed to suggest that after a complete victory at the board or at district court for in reversing the unpatentability determination, maybe there'd be further prosecution on that very claim, and that could lead to actual amendments, I think. And then that amended claim would issue in a patent, and then therefore, under that circumstance, could a patent get PTA?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor has read the regulation correctly. 37 CFR 1.702E, the very last sentence, allows for a C delay. And now again, I'll preface this by saying that 1.702E doesn't lay out every single circumstance under which a patent could ultimately be titled to C delay. But with respect to the last sentence in 1.702E, there are two circumstances that are contemplated for which C delay would be available. There would be a remand reversing an adverse determination of patentability, followed by what Judge Lynn had suggested in his hypothetical, maybe a new ground of rejection by the examiner, which is subsequently overcome through continued examination. Or there is a remand, then followed by a notice of allowance, but then subsequently followed by a request for a continued examination. In both of those cases, ultimately, the issued patent would be traceable to a reversal of an adverse determination of patentability. And so the and that is at least a reasonable interpretation, even if this court may not necessarily think that it's the best interpretation of the C delay provision. And then, Your Honor, with respect to the arguments in the brief concerning regulatory interpretations, the amount of deference owed, I'll rest on the brief unless the court has any questions.
So what is the position of the office as to the intention of the lines that were drawn in the legislation? Is it simply that they were seeking to provide some guidelines so that the policy couldn't be abused by opportunistically refiling and prolonging the prosecution? Or is there more to it than that?
Your Honor, and please correct me if I'm not understanding your question correctly. So the rules, the relevant rule regulations here, 1.702E and 1.703E, were promulgated because Congress told the PTO under 154B3AB to promulgate rules consistent with the statutory language. And so I don't have any sort of insight as to how they arrived at this final language, except for the fact that it does closely adhere to and track, not closely adhere to, it actually tracks the statutory language that a C delay is only available for a patent that was issued under a decision in the review reversing an adverse determination of patentability.
And here, I think just with the conversation this morning, it's apparent that there are perceived ambiguities, in which case we try and figure out what the legislative purpose was within the scope of these ambiguities. And so that was my question to you in terms of what was Congress trying to achieve?
Yeah, Your Honor, so if Your Honor looks to the legislative history that the parties have cited, what they were trying to achieve was essentially to allow a applicant to recoup time on an issued patent when it was issued as a result of a decision reversing an adverse determination of patentability. And so
doesn't that fit squarely within what's happening to this patentee?
Your Honor, it does not. Again, with respect to the 476 patent, that the relevant claim there, claim 11 of the underlying application, it went to the board unpatentable as obvious, and it came back down unpatentable as obvious. And with respect to claim 1 of the underlying application for the 796 patent, again, that went all the way up to the D.C. District Court, unpatentable because it was anticipated by a particular reference, and it was also subject to an ODP rejection. And when it came back down, although the anticipation rejection was gone, it was still subject to the ODP rejection. So there.
But we're not looking at the claims that were finally held unpatentable. We're looking at the claims that were held patentable.
Correct. And there are no claims that were held patentable under any, by any appellate body for either the 796 or the 476 patent.
Well, if nothing was allowed, what's the point of extension?
Well, it's for the other claims that were not before the
exactly.
appellate body. And so, for example, Judge Lynn's example where a claim that's an examiner initially finds is unpatentable goes up to an appellate body, ultimately gets reversed, and then for some reason the applicant decides to cancel it. There's no C delay there because, one, it doesn't fit with the statutory scheme, and it's perfectly sensible not to award C delay there because what that would invite is gamesmanship, where the patents that were originally in a allowable form or patentable are going to be somehow entitled to C delay, even though the claim that garnered the C delay is not ultimately issued.
In my hypothetical, I think what you just said, consistent with the regulation 1702E, was that, well, let me back up. If in my hypothetical, the claim one goes up on appeal, the rejection is reversed, it goes back to the examiner. If the claim is canceled and the originally allowed claim two is the only one left, then there is no extension, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
But if the claim is reversed, claim one goes back, and the applicant, for some reason, instead of canceling the claim, decides to make an amendment, a small amendment, or an amendment of some sort, then the applicant is still entitled to patent term extension?
As long as there's a reversal of an adverse determination of patentability, yes. Your Honor, I see that my time is up.
There is a reversal, but the claim is then amended. So the claim that ultimately issues is different from the one that was on appeal. So in that circumstance, there is a patent term extension, but if the applicant, instead of amending the claim, cancels the claim, there's no patent term extension.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that result, even though it might seem a little odd, is dictated by the plain language of the statute. And I would also just add that in the court's recent decision, I think last year in Chudik, on page 1041 of that opinion, there's a sentence or two about how these choices in prosecution can have an effect on the patent term adjustment, based on what you elect to do. And so, yes, in the scenarios that Your Honor just proposed, the results may seem a little odd, but they are dictated by the plain language of the statute.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Newton, I assume you don't agree with what Mr. Chan just said. Tell me why he's wrong.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So there are several reasons. I'll start with the hypothetical that you gave and this idea that the PTO itself has recognized in 1.702E that there may be further prosecution following an appeal where an adverse determination of patentability is reversed. And if we apply that rationale, that understanding, to the 796 patent, that's exactly what happened here. The district court order said remand to the PTAB, and the PTAB said remand to the examiner and proceed in accordance with the district court's opinion. And that's what happened. Yes, it was recognized that there was an outstanding double patenting rejection, but the remand order said to account for that, which the applicant did by canceling Claim 1, incorporating those limitations, the subject matter that was on appeal, into Claim 2, and the patent was allowed. And that makes sense. That fulfills the purpose of the statute, because that subject matter, if we put aside, okay, we know the statute doesn't talk about the claims, but if we think about what's the purpose of the appeal is to get the subject matter in those claims allowed, that's exactly what happened with respect to the 796 patent. It went up on appeal and said the Freeman prior art reference is not enabled. It can't anticipate this subject matter. And that subject matter got ultimately incorporated into Claim 2, which issued as Claim 1 of the patent. And so if we apply this idea that the PTO put forward, that you have to somehow trace the issued patent back to the appeal decision, well, that's certainly met here. That subject matter in Claim 2 doesn't get allowed if SolStop was not successful on appeal.
There's also the concern about the fact that if we conclude that the statute requires a reversal of all pending rejections on a claim, and then a claim comes back after appellate review, either at the board, district court, or wherever, and still has a pending rejection outstanding, then that wouldn't comply with the terms of the statute.
Just so I understand correctly, so if there's multiple rejections that go up on appeal, and only one is appealed, and that's successful?
Right. I guess if the claim comes back from appellate review with a rejection still outstanding against that claim, even if there is a success to the extent that the appeal managed to knock down one pending rejection against that claim, if it still continues to be unpatentable because of a different outstanding rejection that was never appealed, then the concern I have is that we cannot say that there was an actual reversal of an adverse determination of patentability, because the conclusion as to patentability against that claim still remains unpatentable.
Well, I think in this situation, I think if you have, in that hypothetical, if you have two statutory grounds, anticipation and obviousness, I understand your point. That could be, raise a question of whether there is gaming the system by trying to get appeal of one rejection but keeping the other one out there. I think in practical terms, that's unlikely to happen. And what happened here was it was a non-statutory double patenting rejection, which the case law, the N. Ray Mott case says, when the application that rejection is based on is still pending, there's nothing to do. It doesn't have force or effect of a real rejection. And so here you have the situation where, yes, on paper there were two rejections, but one of them was one that didn't have any force or effect because the co-pending application had not issued. It didn't issue during the entire course of appeal. And so when it came back down, yes, SolStop obviated that rejection, but the real basis of finding that the patent or the claims at issue were unpatentable, the anticipation rejection, that was reversed.
Let me just, I'm not sure that Judge Chen's hypothetical covered this, but let's suppose there's only one claim. It is rejected, 102, anticipated, and also rejected as obvious, 103. Both rejections are then appealed, and the anticipation rejection is overturned, but the obviousness rejection is sustained. What happens? Is there a patent term extension?
Well, I think at that point the claim is dead.
Well, let's assume there's further prosecution and ultimately the examiner withdraws the 103.
Well, if the examiner withdraws the 103, then yes, the statute would give a term adjustment because that appeal was still necessary to get rid of that anticipation bar. Mm-hmm. That's the point. I mean, when you have an anticipation rejection, obvious rejection, those are independent bars to patentability. They prevent you from getting an application until they're lifted, and that's what happened here. SolStop got the anticipation rejection lifted. That allowed it to continue to take what are pretty minor steps of obviating a double patenting rejection, and then the patent was ultimately allowed.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. More questions? Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.